Alpha Room.
Don't look so sad. I know it's over, but life goes on, and this old world will keep on turning. Let's just be glad we had some time to spend together. There's no need to watch the bridges that we're burning. Lay your head upon my pillow. Hold your warm and tender body close to mine. Hear the whisper of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. Father, good time. I'll get along. You'll find another, and I'll be here if you should find you ever need me. Don't say a word about tomorrow or forever. There'll be time enough for sadness when you leave me. Lay your head upon my pillow. Hold your warm and tender body close to mine. Hear the whisper of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. Father, good time.
You go for the good times. Ray Price, terrific singer. Yeah, that's for Ladies Day in the bunker. She-Wolf Day, how about that? Hey, it's January 2nd, 2015, and Freya's Day, and we're working on a full moon. I know that moon shines right in from the west into my bedroom at night, and it's getting brighter every night. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. But not as beautiful as the All-Father's Son. No way. I watched an interesting film on Hulu last night called Ragnarok. And it was about the Vikings and some great stuff. But, seen a lot of people in Viking garb and how they fought a big monster and the whole bit, and it was pretty cool. I liked it. Well, I hope you had a great New Year's. I had a real exciting New Year's. We stayed home and got a big hug and kiss at 12 o'clock, and then I went promptly to bed. I had one drink, and she calls it a mimosa. I never heard of what a mimosa. I know it's got wine in it, but when I drink, I usually have, you know, a vodka or a Kentucky bourbon whiskey or something like that, and not very much. But so I indulged in the mimosa last night, two nights ago. Well, we got a big shoe for you today. I have dug out to go sort of along with our book on Adolf Hitler, the founder of Israel. I've got the speechified book called Dr. Feelgood. This was a movie about, or a book about Max Josephson, this Jew that started out over in Berlin, and I think Dr. Morell was trying to get the information for his happy drink from him, or his happy shots. And I think he might have got part of it, or got a clue, or maybe the Gestapo, I know, was hot on his trail, and he ended up fleeing Germany, but they may have tortured him a little bit and got part of that formula that Dr. Feelgood used, not only on that Morell got a hold of and used on Hitler. So I say Hitler was poisoned. That's what I've said all along, that many of his bizarre moves and mistakes, including Operation Barbarossa and the Leningrad crap and Dunkirk and all those mistakes, were because he was being shot up with methamphetamines. And we know that to be true. And Morell was a total quack doctor, shooting him full of methamphetamines and all kinds of stuff. So after a certain point, I think Hitler was out of control. He didn't know quite what was happening, and it led to his getting sicker and sicker and sicker, and then he evidently developed Parkinson's disease. But nobody wants to talk about these things, so I'm trying to bring them out and link them all together on how this Max Josephson and his goofy formulas turning world leaders into drug addicts, like he did roundabout way Hitler and then John F. Kennedy here in this country, and a whole bunch of other noted people. So we started playing a couple of chapters of that today on the show, and I think we'll go right on through it and get that over, and then we'll go back to Hitler, Israel's founder, father. And you might want to comment on some of this stuff and see what, do you think I'm on the right track here, or am I like the right wing says, a crummy Bolshevik and an idiot? Okay, here we go. Now I have to link these files together because I got them screwed up here. But well, the main thing I wanted to do is put the Dr. Feelgood in a separate file, so we're going to have that all on one MP3 file, so it can be sent around to different people without having me talking on it. Okay, here we go. Dr. Feelgood.
Preface. When you approach a story, no matter how sensational it seems on the surface, the more you explore its ramifications, the twists it takes, and the bends it makes like a winding river, the more you come to an appreciation and an understanding of the larger picture than the story itself points to. This is exactly what we discovered as we uncovered the story of Dr. Max Jacobson, an individual who, in some fundamental ways, influenced American history, even if his influence was tangential rather than immediately intentional. What we discovered, and what we want to establish beyond the sensationalism of this story, is how a single individual, Max Jacobson, because of a synthesized drug he developed that behaves like a fast-spreading virus, became a lightning rod for an entity, public, political, or commercial, that wanted to use him. He was a drug addict because he injected himself with his own methamphetamine-laced concoctions, and he addicted others, propelled by a psychosis that came from the methamphetamine itself. Even more than a sensational story, this is a fascinating case study of how human connections form, spread, and deteriorate so as to change the course of history. What Max Jacobson did still affects us today in how the press operates and in our war on drugs. When we looked at the totality of Max Jacobson's effect on American culture, albeit having started inside a niche segment of that culture, the lives that were destroyed or otherwise influenced and the spread of Max Jacobson's influence across cultural lines, we realized that we were looking at more than a story about a drug. We were looking at a type of social phenomenon, something that British scientist and author Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene, Oxford University Press, 1976, might call a meme, which was working its way through a social network that Max Jacobson helped create. But we soon found that this was more than something that Max Jacobson created. Because Jacobson himself was an addict controlled by methamphetamine, it was the drug that had become the meme, just as it remains today as a party drug of choice, though ingested in a different form. We found that all the way from a popular Aretha Franklin song about Dr. Feelgood to a Blake Edwards motion picture that featured a meth-injecting doctor at Hollywood parties, to serious political histories by Seymour Hersh and Robert Dalek, Max Jacobson had been an anecdotal cultural footnote when, in fact, he was the spear point of a cultural change in America. And that is what this book documents. Our study of the infamous Dr. Feelgood, Dr. Max Jacobson, had a narrow beginning as a show business biography of motion picture and television star Robert Cummings, who was widely known as one of the first health food advocates in Hollywood and had written a hugely successful book, How to Stay Young and Vital, in 1960, that sold millions of copies. We started out to write the story of how this self-described, clean-living popular figure, who had starred in Alfred Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder and Saboteur, and co-starred with Ronald Reagan, fell into a precipitous decline because of his addiction to Max Jacobson's drug cocktail. As our interviews circled out from actor Dwayne Hickman of the many loves of Dobie Gillis fame and Cummings' co-star in Love That Bob, we realized that Cummings' relationship with Jacobson mirrored Jacobson's relationships with many show business figures, artists, and even key political figures such as President Kennedy. We realized we were on the trail of a larger story about how some of America's most influential personalities from the 1940s to the 1970s were influenced by a drug and the provider of that drug. As we talked to other celebrities of that period, former Jacobson patients, and historians who shared their own records with us, what we thought was our story of Bob Cummings soon became the story of Jack and Jackie Kennedy. Soon such figures as J. Edgar Hoover, Senator Claude Pepper, Vice President Spiro Agnew, and even Presidents Richard Nixon and Harry Truman became involved. Who was Max Jacobson, and how did the drug he synthesized exert so much influence? What was really at work as the drug spread, and how had it remained under the radar for more than 30 years, only to emerge in a headline-making story on the pages of the New York Times and in the news broadcasts of a crusading young Geraldo Rivera? To find the truths behind the Max Jacobson story, we have traveled throughout the United States to interview American legends from all walks of life, those who were Max Jacobson's patients and family members and friends of patients. We learned that Jacobson's influence extended worldwide and that his drug cocktail affected the lives of some of the most influential leaders of the 20th century. Our pursuit to research the life and denouement of Max Jacobson began in Branson, Missouri, with an interview with singer Andy Williams, thence to Washington, D.C., for conversations with journalist Cy Hersh and socialite Toni Bradley, the sister of ex-JFK mistress Mary Pinchot Meyer. Then, after researching FBI and CIA public documents, we met with C. David Hyman in Manhattan. In New York, we also spoke to noted psychiatrist Dr. Lawrence Hatterer, who treated President Kennedy at New York's Carlyle Hotel after an injection from Max Jacobson that so overdosed the president that he began running naked through the halls of the hotel. We also spoke to Max Jacobson's best friend, World War II hero and Medal of Honor recipient, Michael Samick, a chemical engineer who understood what Max was mixing up in his lab and tried to help him organize his business, even as New York state authorities were closing in. The list of former patients and celebrities who were friends of patients was extensive and included show business icons Jerry Lewis, Tony Curtis, George Clooney, Roscoe Lee Brown, singer Phyllis McGuire, actresses Alice Ghostly and Julie Newmar, Ed Asner, William Shallert of The Patty Duke Show, the late Art Linkletter, our friend Dwayne Hickman, comedian Joey Bishop, actor Jamie Farr from MASH, comedy writer Larry Gelbart, television legend Milton Berle, and many others, more than we can mention here. Our research also included medical doctors, pharmacology experts, and Max Jacobson's son, Dr. Thomas Jacobson. Interviews also included writers Roger Rappaport, the Super Doctors, Nina Burley, a very private woman, about the death of Mary Pinchot Meyer, professor and Kennedy scholar Robert Dalek, writer and journalist Jane Levy, the last boy, Mickey Mantle, writer Kurt Smith, the voice, Mel Allen, and famed writer A.E. Hotchner, who co-founded the Newman's Own food brand with Paul Newman. Just reviewing the list of Max Jacobson's patients in the appendix will give you an understanding of the breadth of Jacobson's reach and the level of research into medical files and the depth of the interviews. Information from New York Times columnist and journalist Jane Brody, New York Times journalist Lawrence Altman, journalist and former New York Times reporter Boyce Rensberger, writer Frederick Kemp, Berlin, 1961, historian Lawrence Lehmer and writer Gore Vidal provided much-needed background about Jacobson and his patients within the context of American cultural history from 1940 through the early 1970s. We wondered how many other lives were destroyed by this supposed vitamin cocktail that was supplied by the person the Secret Service codenamed Dr. Feelgood. How had this German immigrant impacted American history? We relied on information provided by the late C. David Hyman, who had extensively interviewed John F. Kennedy Jr., and whose research into the influence of Max Jacobson on both President Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy made him aware of the dark secret that ran like an underground stream through Camelot. We learned far more than we had bargained for, particularly discovering that heroes of our generation, cultural icons, and the screen and television actors who influenced our outlook on life were, after all, still human beings plagued with many of the shortcomings that plague the rest of us. We learned the dark truths about the final weeks of Marilyn Monroe, J. Edgar Hoover's secret addiction to methamphetamines, Mickey Mantle's use of performance-enhancing drugs, as well as his reliance on Max Jacobson during the Mick's home run derby with Yankee teammate Roger Maris, and the solution to the Mary Meyer murder in Georgetown, and her shared drug addiction with the president, to whom she brought LSD tabs from her friend Dr. Timothy Leary, all under the watchful eyes of James Jesus Angleton of the CIA. The full story of Dr. Max Jacobson, his influence, his medicines, his rise and fall, and how he became a useful tool for the KGB, the CIA, the New York State Board of Regents, and the American national media has never been told until now. As jaded as we are, we admit to having been completely astonished. On December 3, 1979, funeral services were held for Dr. Max Jacobson at the Frank E. Campbell Funeral Chapel at Madison Avenue at 81st Street in his adopted hometown of New York City. The Campbell Chapel has been the home of countless notable funerals, including those held for Irving Berlin, Joan Crawford, Bat Masterson, Judy Garland, Walter Cronkite, Rudolph Valentino, Tennessee Williams, mob boss Frank Costello, and many others. Jacobson's was a traditional Jewish memorial, followed by a shiva, a Jewish mourning period, in which the deceased family receives condolences at home. Jacobson's friend, Michael Samick, remembered that the funeral was well attended and that Jacobson was buried at a cemetery in Long Island. The celebrities in attendance at Dr. Jacobson's funeral attested to the doctor's extensive influence in the entertainment industry, among artists and writers, and in the world of politics and government. the impact of the life and practices of Dr. Max Jacobson has reverberated for decades. There have been more than 200 books touching on Jacobson, his drugs, and the lives he destroyed. Some of these books were written by patients who knew him intimately, such as Doris Shapiro's We Danced All Night, and Eddie Fisher's Been There, Done That, while others were written by historians and popular writers, such as Roger Rappaport's The Super Doctors, which takes a deeper look at Jacobson within a medical and historical context. Movies such as Blake Edwards' S.O.B. have parodied him, and songs such as Aretha Franklin's Dr. Feelgood have immortalized him. The deaths of former patients have been blamed on him, such as Jackie Kennedy's fatal lymphoma and actor Bob Cummings' decline and his death from Parkinson's disease. There were many other deaths, including Kennedy family photographer and Jacobson friend Mark Shaw, Alan J. Lerner, and Max's own wife, Nina. Whether lionized or vilified by his patients, Dr. Max Jacobson has become a part of the fabric of the 20th century. There have been credible studies of his impact on John F. Kennedy Jr. by popular historians such as Robert Dallek, Seymour Hersh, Richard Reeves, Frederick Kemp, C. David Hyman, Barbara Lemming, and Lawrence Lehmer, all of whom reported that JFK's life was deeply influenced by his relationship with Jacobson. The internet is replete with conspiracy theories surrounding Jacobson. Radio talk show hosts have held discussions on the Jacobson effect. His nickname, Dr. Feelgood, is now commonly used to refer to numerous modern doctors whose misuse of drugs caused their patients harm or death, such as the late Michael Jackson's physician, Dr. Conrad Murray. Even the widespread use of methamphetamines in the United States has been blamed on Jacobson. Dr. Leslie Iverson, one of the leading experts on amphetamine use and a professor of pharmacology at Oxford University, directly links Jacobson's drug practices to the current spread of methamphetamines. Ironically, despite all his influence and notoriety, Max Jacobson did not become a rich man by any account. Claims such as the one made by actor Felice Orlandi that Jacobson ran a global amphetamine syndicate that made millions of dollars were not borne out by reality. Jacobson himself complained that the legal defense he raised before the state of New York was so expensive that he was afraid it might wipe him out. In their expose of Jacobson on December 4, 1972, Boyce Renzenberger, Jane Brody, and Lawrence Altman of the New York Times wrote that despite Max Jacobson's rich clientele of patients, he lived very modestly in what could be called a middle-class apartment. His best friend, Michael Samick, noted that Max never got rich. He never set up a proper billing system. He was never paid by many patients, and that includes President Kennedy. Max was a very compassionate person. He wanted to help his patients. Max always said, "It's better to feel good than to feel sick." Treating patients was his life, not money. He saw his practice as a sort of mission. Michael Samick, Private Interview, January 12, 2007. The debate continues as to whether Jacobson was a fraud and a charlatan or a cutting-edge and compassionate physician. As fascinating as Jacobson's story is in and of itself, it is also the story of methamphetamine, a drug that deludes those who use it into thinking they are larger than life. The drug is a Venus flytrap that lures and traps and then finally kills its victims. On a positive note, medical licensing laws changed because of Jacobson. The war on drugs emerged, in a small measure, out of the scandal surrounding Jacobson. Because of the influence he wielded with a drug that frightened federal secret intelligence agencies, conspirators within those agencies took extreme measures to protect power they felt belonged to them. Jacobson not only was an instrument of destruction, inadvertently as well as deliberately, as he sought to exert his control over those around him, he also was a tool used by the media to sell newspapers as the Nixon administration crumbled from within. He was vilified not just in the print and broadcast media, but by the New York State regulators, who revoked his license to practice medicine as they made an example of a person they believed had abused every aspect of medical procedure when it came to preparing and dispensing medication. In a larger sense, too, Max Jacobson became the poster boy for drug abuse, and in the wake of his exposure, the federal government created and then prosecuted its war on drugs. Perhaps the most ironic aspect of the Max Jacobson story was the way it demonstrated how human networks formed, how a drug addiction can spread virally among specific groups, and how an individual at the center of that network, just like a spider, can weave and spread his web to ensnare others. Indeed, we can call the Jacobson story a tragedy, but it's an illustrative tragedy showcasing the ways human beings influence others so as to create an entire social movement. As grandiose as this sounds, it's true.
This is Walter Denham.
Chapter 1. JFK and Dr. Max Jacobson in Camelot. If you look backwards, you face the future with your ass. Dr. Max Jacobson. Mrs. Dunn is calling, the office receptionist announced. A hunched-over, bespectacled man in a dirty, blood-stained lab coat looked up from under a curl of thick black hair, first at the syringe he was holding, and then at his receptionist, and nodded. No matter what he was doing, Dr. Max Jacobson would take the call. Mrs. Dunn always took precedence. Mrs. Dunn was John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States. Dunn was the code name concocted by the President and the mysterious doctor from their earliest encounters. Ever since the first televised debate in the 1960 presidential campaign, Max Jacobson had become JFK's unofficial doctor, keeping him upright, functioning, and invigorated. But it was a tightly kept secret, hidden from the American public and, as much as possible, from the press corps that followed the young president everywhere he went. No American could know that his president was calling on a doctor who had fled the Nazi takeover of Germany and who worked out of a small, cluttered Upper East Side Manhattan office to summon him to the White House, where from time to time he received special injections. And Dr. Max Jacobson, although proud of what he was doing, dutifully kept the secret. Jacobson was on the radar of both the CIA and the FBI, not simply because of his proximity to JFK, but because in the eyes of these intelligence and counter-espionage services, he had become a person of interest. In addition to his association with known communist agents, Jacobson was also treating CIA officers. Among those officers was former OSS officer and JFK family photographer Mark Shaw. Both FBI and CIA interest only intensified when Jack Kennedy's old college roommate, Chuck Spalding, introduced Jacobson to the then Democratic candidate for president, whom Max began treating in 1960. As a consequence of Max's associations and his new relationship with JFK, his office was placed under surveillance. FBI surveillance of Max's office noted, as did a reference in the CIA file, that Dr. Jacobson was treating an affluent, highly circumscribed clientele of patients, most of whom were connected to the arts. Although there was no speculation regarding the nature of Max's treatments, both agencies remarked that Max's high-profile clientele were devoted followers of the doctor. However, in at least one note in Max's FBI file, the agency said that although Max described himself as a researcher for treating multiple sclerosis, the FBI noted that the Multiple Sclerosis Society referred to Jacobson as a quack and a charlatan, a complaint that would later be lodged against him by Mark Shaw's widow, actress Pat Suzuki. Private interview, April 30, 2007. On a Sunday in February 1963, Jacobson's office was nearly destroyed by a break-in. Papers were removed, medical vials were missing, and the office was completely trashed. It had been assumed that the raid came from the FBI. When we acquired the FBI files through FOIA, there was much that was redacted and missing. JFK's orthopedic specialist, Dr. Han Krauss, suffered a similar break-in. His Manhattan office was ransacked once, which President Kennedy and others blamed on J. Edgar Hoover, who was compiling a file on the Kennedys for his own purposes of self-protection. Robert Kennedy had made no bones about wanting to replace Hoover at the FBI, even talking to Police Chief William H. Parker in Los Angeles about taking over the bureau. Dr. Krauss wisecracked, "Even if Hoover had gotten his hands on Kennedy's files, which he didn't, all that would have happened is that he would have discovered that Kennedy did exercises." Ken McKnight recalled, "The Food and Drug Administration was on Max's back the whole time I knew him. After he began treating JFK and he became president, the FBI also began snooping around. Codenamed Dr. Feelgood by the Secret Service detail guarding the president, Max Jacobson was an omnipresent figure among those surrounding President Kennedy and First Lady Jacqueline during the 2.5 years they occupied the White House. Jacobson and his wife had accompanied the president to meet Charles de Gaulle in Paris and would also be present at the Vienna summit with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev in June 1961. The Jacobsons attended the president's birthday party at Madison Square Garden and were frequent visitors at the Kennedy compound at Hyannisport, at the West Palm Beach Winter White House, and at other celebrations. But only a select few, including the president's brother, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, actually knew what was at the core of the president's relationship with Dr. Jacobson. It was the medicine, and the president was addicted to it. As would be revealed decades later in a nasty hearing before the New York State Medical Licensing Board and an exposé in the New York Times, Max Jacobson's magic elixir was a concoction of different types of blood serum mixed with a powerful methamphetamine stimulant. This mixture of liquid methamphetamines injected directly into the president's bloodstream gave the president, who suffered constant pain from back injuries, a reliable source of energy and a mental high. But as JFK, Jackie, Marilyn Monroe, and scores of Dr. Jacobson's other patients would ultimately discover, what Miracle Max, as he was nicknamed by singer Eddie Fisher, touted as his liquid vitamin cocktail actually came at a huge cost. A regimen of methamphetamine resulted in severe neuropsychological reactions, including manic depression or bipolar disorder, hypersexuality, and paranoid hypergrandiosity. In President Kennedy's case, that reaction caused the almost stupor-like depression that he fell into while coming down from his meth high during the Vienna summit with Khrushchev, and set into motion the chain of events that would ultimately cost him his own life. Max Jacobson's connection to the Kennedys began in 1960, when one of Jacobson's patients, Chuck Spalding, Kennedy's former roommate at Harvard, placed a very confidential phone call to him to request a private consultation on behalf of an unidentified friend. This friend was in a tight situation, Spalding said, and needed Jacobson's medical advice. Jacobson had been introduced to Spalding by internationally known fashion photographer Mark Shaw, who was another of his patients. Jacobson had in turn met Shaw through his longtime friend, World War II Army Air Force glider pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Mike Samick, whose wife was an editor at New York's Mademoiselle magazine. Shaw, like Samick, had been an officer in the OSS during the war, and like most members of the American clandestine services, never left the profession. From the OSS, Shaw had become an unofficial cover officer for the CIA, a job that required complete anonymity, a legend or a cover profession to mask what he really did, and the ability to insinuate himself into critical relationships to send intelligence information back to the agency. As an internationally recognized photographer, Shaw had almost unlimited access to the popularly termed jet set of the 1950s by virtue of his acclaimed magazine spreads featuring Audrey Hepburn, Pablo Picasso, Brigitte Bardot, Elizabeth Taylor, Danny Kaye, Grace Kelly, Cary Grant, Yves Saint Laurent, and countless other high-profile notables in art, literature, and show business around the world. But the 1950s were also the decade of the Red Scare and the Blacklist. With Senator Joseph McCarthy's hearings stoking the flames of fear, the American public was becoming obsessively paranoid over the threat of communist infiltration of American institutions, especially in the entertainment industry and halls of government. Mark Shaw, therefore, was the consummate fly on the wall, snapping away his photos and privy to intimate conversations held in unguarded moments, conversations of which he took very careful note. Shaw also presented an additional opportunity to his handlers at the CIA. Because of his relationship with friends in high places, Shaw had established a relationship with the Kennedys and ultimately became the official Kennedy family photographer after JFK won the 1960 election. But before that, Mark Shaw introduced his old friend Chuck Spalding to Dr. Jacobson. Soon Spalding, as well as Shaw, would become addicted to the substance in Max's magic injections. Thus, when Jack Kennedy called and complained of his lack of stamina during the campaign, Spalding placed the confidential phone call asking Max to consult with the then Massachusetts senator who was running for president against Vice President Richard M. Nixon. It was in the early fall of 1960, just before the celebrated first televised presidential Kennedy-Nixon debate, when Spalding made the call. "Can you handle this consultation with utmost secrecy?" Spalding asked before finally identifying his former roommate by name. It was vital that Jacobson take extreme steps to avoid any public scrutiny. The last thing JFK needed was to be spotted visiting this strange Manhattan doctor. JFK already had been outed in the media over his health issues, and his campaign staff had spent time dispelling those potentially harmful rumors. Kennedy the candidate's Addison's disease, constant back pain, high stress, migraines, and gastrointestinal disorders all had to be kept secret from the public. There was acute vigilance by the Kennedy staff to keep JFK's illnesses under the radar. JFK's father, Joseph Kennedy, had always carefully guarded the secret from the moment his son became a congressman and later passed this duty on to son Bobby. However, in May 1962, rumors began to swirl that JFK was under the care of Dr. Jacobson. Esquire magazine's managing editor, Harold Hayes, commissioned writer and Jacobson patient Arthur Stoyer to do a story about JFK's employing Dr. Jacobson as his physician. Jacobson, who by 1962 felt secure in his position with JFK and was not shy at boasting about his treatment of the president, told Stoyer of his relationship and history with the president. This caused a flap in the media that had to be quieted. The Kennedy advisors strongly believed that any leak of the president's illness would weaken the office of the president and strongly derail his influence, and Jacobson was later scolded for his loose talk. The task fell to none other than Mrs. Kennedy's chief of staff and social secretary, Letitia Baldridge, who responded to Mr. Stoyer's inquiry on White House letterhead, saying that her brother, Howard Malcolm Baldridge, Jr., a former Secretary of Commerce, was going to use Dr. Jacobson for his Marie Stumpel's disease, implying that it was not JFK who would receive treatment from the doctor. But despite any cover-ups to the press, it was John F. Kennedy himself who invited Dr. Jacobson to the White House to treat him and Jackie and ultimately asked Jacobson to move into the White House so he could be close at hand. But none of what was in the future was evident in the summer of 1960 when JFK had his first meeting with Jacobson. At that time, Senator Kennedy was perceived by the media to be a youthful and vigorous naval war hero. The cover-up of the senator's poor health was in full steam during the campaign, even though rumors had begun to swirl about his wartime injuries and bad back. On July 5, 1960, Kennedy physicians Dr. Janet Travel and Dr. Eugene J. Cohen sent a signed letter to JFK for public dissemination that was created specifically for those they called the media vultures, in which they flatly denied that the senator was in ill health. The letter stated, "As your physicians for over 5 years and with knowledge of your medical records for over 15 years, we wish to provide you with a straightforward, brief medical statement concerning your health. As stated to you in our recent letter of 6-11-60, we reiterate that you are in superb physical condition. You should see your doctors once or twice a year for a routine checkup. No limitations are placed on your arduous activities." This letter was distributed to targeted friends in the press. It was an utter fabrication and a complete cover-up of Senator John Kennedy's physical condition. With the old line establishment physicians Travel and Cohen protecting the Kennedy mystique from the press, JFK looked below the radar to find relief from the persistent pain that was draining his strength and causing him great fatigue. Not unlike Michael Jackson, who sought out willing physicians to ease his pain, Kennedy reached out to his friends to find his own sub rosa doctor, and he found him on New York's Upper East Side. Unlike the upscale and fashionable office of Dr. Travel on West 16th Street, just north of New York's Greenwich Village, and only a few blocks away from Union Square, Max's East 72nd Street office in Manhattan was not a typical medical practice. It was more like a research lab with a celebrity waiting room. Actress Alice Ghostly's husband, Felice Orlandi, who worked as Max's assistant for several years in the 1960s, remembered that Jacobson's office was often a complete and utter disaster area. Papers were all over the office, waste cans were overfilled, syringes were strewn across the floor, empty vials were everywhere. He was too cheap to hire a cleaning service. His back lab was like a war zone. Max muttered and mumbled quite a bit. He reminded me a bit like Vincent Price in one of his horror films. His fingernails were just absolutely filthy, and he reeked of tobacco and formaldehyde. Jacobson's close friend, Mike Samick, concurred about the office. I tried to impress upon Max to clean up the office. In fact, I spent a weekend with a neighborhood kid, and we built a wall of shelving in his lab to restore order. It even had slots where he could label the ingredients. Max had a perverse sense of humor and enjoyed the clutter. He claimed that there was an organization to the disorganization. There was very little regulation by the state in that time. A frequent Jacobson patient, singer Eddie Fisher, later recalled that the office looked more like a chemist's laboratory than a doctor's office, and Max looked like a mad scientist, I guess. I remember noticing at our first meeting that his fingernails were filthy, stained with chemicals. He was nothing like any other doctor I'd ever met. He was a German refugee with big, thick glasses, a big, thick accent, and a completely commanding personality. Jacobson, who was 60 years old when he met Senator Kennedy, was still a robust man. He was a dedicated swimmer who stayed in good physical condition by doing multiple laps every morning. He had been an amateur boxer and studied jiu-jitsu. He was barrel-chested and quite muscular, but had a prominent pot belly and cut a hulking, disheveled figure with large, horn-rimmed glasses with thick lenses that magnified roaming, unsettled eyes. After taking the phone call from Chuck Spalding, Jacobson became anxious. A promised relationship with a politically prominent patient was as mysterious as it was exciting. Late that same afternoon, the senator showed up. The office, which was usually jam-packed with celebrity patients, such as Truman Capote, Tennessee Williams, Alan J. Lerner, and Anthony Quinn, was now deserted. Jacobson had cleared all of them out. Just as Spalding had promised to his former roommate, the doctor was gracious, but he stared at the young Democratic presidential candidate through the eyes of a physician, as well as a civilian basking in the glow of the senator's charismatic presence. Jacobson stared long and hard because he believed that by looking directly into someone's eyes, he could learn everything there was to learn about the person. He was impressed by Kennedy's earnestness and what he perceived to be the candidate's clarity. He noted every aspect of Kennedy's physical condition even before they spoke. In his own records, Jacobson remembered JFK as especially thin, with long fatigue lines in his face and sagging cheeks. The candidate said that he had given the slip to his security personnel because, as he made clear, he wanted complete anonymity. Jacobson reassured him that he would keep absolutely confidential all their conversations. Although Senator Kennedy tried to be affable as he stood uncomfortably in Jacobson's office, the doctor could tell he was put off by the cramped space and Jacobson's disheveled appearance. To break the tension, Kennedy began by making small talk about Mark Shaw, who had just been put on a special assignment to photograph Kennedy and his family. Kennedy said that both Shaw and Chuck Spalding had spoken very highly of Jacobson's medical procedures, which had helped them overcome the intense strain of their professions. Both of them had recommended that Kennedy pay Jacobson a visit after a brutal primary campaign against Senators Hubert Humphrey and Lyndon Johnson that left him in need of a jumpstart now that the general election campaign was in full swing. What was Kennedy's medical complaint? Jacobson, ever the skilled diagnostician, asked this while peering at his new patient. It was the demands of the campaign, Kennedy explained. It was draining him. He was fatigued. His muscles felt weak. And this weakness was interfering with his concentration and his speech. Worse, he was getting laryngitis. He was looking ahead to a series of televised debates with his opponent, Vice President Nixon, a fierce and seasoned debater, a street fighter who was known to go after his opponent's jugulars. Kennedy was worried, and the strain was taking its toll. Even though they had been friends and colleagues in the United States Senate, Kennedy had no illusions about how Nixon would go after him in the debates. Jacobson was not at all surprised by Kennedy's description of his physical problems. The senator's complaints, however, constituted the most common symptoms of stress, which, in Jacobson's opinion, if not addressed, would only become more severe. He took a short case history, asking the presidential candidate about any previous diseases he had contracted, accidents or injuries from the war, and treatments he had been given. JFK started by describing his Addison's disease and how it resulted in extreme weakness, fluctuations in blood pressure, and chronic diarrhea and nausea, among other symptoms. Kennedy also told the doctor about the chronic and often acute back pain that had resulted from injuries he had incurred while commanding a badly damaged and sinking PT boat in the South Pacific in World War II. Kennedy, who had suffered bone loss and was taking more than a few hot showers a day as a kind of hydrotherapy, was almost crippled by the pain. He wasn't wheelchair-bound, as Franklin Roosevelt had been after he contracted polio, but he needed medication just to be able to walk without crutches and to keep his pain at a low ebb. Kennedy's back pain was being dealt with by Dr. Janet Travel, who had prescribed injections of Procaine Novocaine. This handicap, according to Barbara Leeming, was also difficult to hide from a public that thought of him as athletic and robust. Something as simple as bending over a lectern to read a speech caused him terrible pain. Janet Travel worked with engineers to design a reading stand that would reduce the pain. However, Dr. Travel's specialty was traditionally orthopedic. Jacobson was the miracle doctor Kennedy needed to help him regain his energy. Kennedy also revealed that he drank not an insubstantial amount of alcohol, partly because it went with a politician's territory of constantly having to attend social affairs. But Kennedy enjoyed drinking too, he said. Jacobson was not a fan of alcohol himself and often weaned his patients off it. In Kennedy's case, it would prove to be an issue that his doctor would have to address constantly. Kennedy was also very forthcoming about the prescription drugs he was taking. He was literally living in a chemical bath of medications. There was the phenobarbital to control his irritable bowel syndrome, the cortisone steroids for his Addison's disease, the painkillers for his back, a series of sleeping aids, and antibiotics for various infections, including those of the urinary tract. He even took testosterone, which combined with the effects of the methamphetamine, made Kennedy sexually ravenous. Although there was not much Jacobson could do about the Addison's disease, he assured Kennedy that his vitamin cocktail could help him manage the stress, extreme fatigue, and muscle weakness in preparation for the upcoming debates. After all, as Jacobson often told his patients, the treatment of stress was one of his specialties. Given Kennedy's medical condition, he knew the administration of a powerful stimulant might be dangerous, but at least it would give the young candidate enough energy to keep on facing the demands of the campaign head-on. It was a risk Jacobson was willing to take. Not to worry, he told the candidate. He would be available to help Kennedy on a moment's notice. It would be his pleasure. Kennedy readily agreed to anything that would help him withstand the pain and give him back his strength. He didn't give a second thought about what was in the vial that Jacobson inserted into the needle of his syringe. Dr. Jacobson's first injection took immediate effect as the methamphetamines hit his bloodstream. Suddenly, JFK, who had entered the office tired and weak, had a bounce in his step and could move more easily, despite the pain that he lived with every day of his adult life. He felt stronger, cool, focused, and very alert, he said. It was almost as if the patient had become another person, emerging like the mythical phoenix from the tired shell that had walked into the waiting room. Others have described what Kennedy must have felt. Eddie Fisher said that after receiving the injection from Jacobson's inch-and-a-half needle, he felt as if he was being lit up from within. Truman Capote described it as instant euphoria. You feel like Superman. You're flying. Ideas come at the speed of light. You go 72 hours straight without so much as a coffee break. You don't need sleep. You don't need nourishment. If it's sex you're after, you go all night. Then you crash. It's like falling down a well, like parachuting without a parachute. You want to hold on to something, and there's nothing out there but air. You're going running back to East 72nd Street. You're looking for the German mosquito, the insect with the magic pinprick. He stings you, and all at once, you're soaring again. So it was with John Kennedy. Jacobson gave him a bottle of vitamin drops, essentially another dose of methamphetamine, that he instructed him to take orally right before the debate with Nixon. That would fix him up, Jacobson said. After his patient left, Jacobson felt satisfied that he had managed to effect symptomatic relief for the young senator. But it was more than satisfaction. Jacobson already knew the long-term addictive effects of his injections. It only took one extraordinary high, followed by an equally extraordinary crash, and the patient would be back for more special elixir, and would thereafter be under Jacobson's control. Control was the key, and Jacobson knew how to exert it. While it could be said that Jacobson influenced the works of composer Leonard Bernstein, author Truman Capote, composer Alan J. Lerner, and playwright Tennessee Williams with his magic potion, the doctor's crowning achievement was on the night of the first Nixon debate, where many have conjectured that the history of American politics changed. Nixon, who barely lost the popular vote in 1960 by just over 100,000 votes, was as powerful and aggressive a debater when it came to slugging it out as ever there was. Nixon extolled the virtues of a rock'em sock'em campaign, bringing the fight directly to his opponent, whom he regarded as the enemy. As for Kennedy, although he had studied hard and tried to rest in preparation for the debate, he was hoarse and weak, his laryngitis had returned, and he was no match for the emboldened Richard Nixon, who was ahead in the polls. On the evening of September 26, 1960, Kennedy visited Jacobson again, complaining in a voice barely above a whisper of extreme fatigue and lethargy. This time, Jacobson inserted his needle directly into Kennedy's throat and pumped methamphetamine into his voice box. The result was apparent in minutes. By the time Kennedy appeared on camera in his dark suit and professional makeup before an audience of 70 million television viewers, he seemed younger and far more vigorous than his opponent, the heavily perspiring vice president with the 5 o'clock shadow. Kennedy, who had been moribund, exhausted, and hoarse prior to the injection, was suddenly charismatic and radiated an energy that was contagious. The difference between the candidates' appearances, their demeanors, and the way they responded to the questions made such an impression on the national viewing audience that in the polls, more than half of the voting public said they favored Kennedy's performance over Nixon's. Whereas Kennedy entered the debate behind Nixon, he emerged slightly ahead and gained the edge on that first night. That favorable initial impression was clearly important because fewer people watched the ensuing debates. That first debate changed the outcome of the presidential campaign and, quite possibly, altered the course of modern American history. That debate performance also put Max Jacobson at the top of JFK's medical priority list. JFK did not forget who and what had made him feel good. As Jacobson would record in his own notes, Kennedy had the ability to make someone feel as if that person were the most important person in the world. And for a refugee from Germany, the son of a kosher butcher who fled the Holocaust and struggled to gain a medical practice in New York in the late 1940s, Kennedy's bestowal of trust and friendship meant that he was accepted by the most powerful man on earth. It was a source of great pride. Jacobson became a regular, if not constant, member of the Kennedy entourage. He responded to every summons from Mrs. Dunn and reinvigorated the president with his injections. After JFK won the election, he invited the Jacobsons to attend the inauguration and the balls that followed. The Jacobsons were excited about attending the Kennedy inauguration, not just because of the honor it bestowed, but because it also foretold a long and friendly relationship with JFK, a relationship that would put Jacobson in some of the most affluent and powerful circles in the world. He relished the opportunity and the power it conferred. Here he was treating the President of the United States by means of a potion that controlled the President's every emotion, his psychological state, and his physical capabilities. For a control freak like Max Jacobson, this was the ultimate. Doris Shapiro, who is Alan J. Lerner's assistant and one of Jacobson's patients, wrote, "Big Max, with his false savagery, thrived on dispensing his mythical powers." Shapiro claimed that Max was not a simple charlatan. He was a far more complicated one, brilliant, mysterious in his power to manipulate and orchestrate all the body's systems and the mental ones as well. He had about him a symptom of greatness. But he was corrupt to the core. The most frightening part was that Max Jacobson now had control of the most powerful person in the world. Inauguration Day, 1961. The morning was crisp, and the air so cold that attendees could see the condensation from their breath freezing in the falling snow. The Jacobsons and their hosts, Senator Claude Pepper and his wife, were among the early arrivals and took their reserved seats about 50 yards from the presidential platform. Looking around at the shivering guests, Jacobson was concerned about the health and resilience of the president-elect. JFK had now become his personal president, and Jacobson extended his mantle of professional proprietorship over him. Jacobson peered at the crowd of dignitaries seated near the platform, picking out President Eisenhower, Vice President Nixon, and his soon-to-be patient, JFK's wife, Jackie. Despite the cold, and despite the crowd's amazement that the new president-elect, about to be sworn in, removed his overcoat before the ceremony, everyone in attendance was wildly enthusiastic during Kennedy's inaugural address, a speech in which he laid out his agenda for a new generation of American leaders. Jacobson, who saw himself as key to Kennedy's victory because of his medical help, was especially proud of what his treatments had accomplished. Due to the weather and Washington traffic, the Jacobsons and Peppers didn't reach the celebratory ball until close to midnight, where they met the legendary Joseph P. Kennedy and billionaire Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr., shook the new president's hand, and watched Frank Sinatra perform in an astronaut costume. It was Jacobson's dream come true, and to think that it all started with a single injection to help Senator Kennedy overcome campaign stress and fatigue. Yes, Dr. Max Jacobson, who'd fled for his life from Nazi Berlin, had finally made it. Despite the fact that he had been invited to the inaugural events, Jacobson was still surprised when he received a phone call from the White House prior to the president's trip to Canada in 1961. Dr. Janet Travel was on the other end, and she asked him detailed questions about his treatment of the president's stress. Travel explained that she needed to ensure Jacobson's treatment plan did not conflict with hers. Max explained how his treatments involved his special vitamin injections and how these injections relieved the president's fatigue. Jacobson never shared the ingredients for his magic elixir with either colleagues or patients, even some of whom, such as Truman Capote, lived in fear that no other physician could duplicate the formula in case Jacobson was unavailable. Renowned New York psychiatrist Dr. Lawrence Hatterer once asked Jacobson for the ingredients of his formula to be able to treat his former patients now seeing Hatterer. Jacobson flatly replied, "I'll be glad to inject you with the drug so you can understand its effect." Hatterer promptly refused the offer. Jacobson now tried the same tack with Travel and offered to send her the information in writing just in case she didn't get everything over the phone, as well as a sample of the fluid he was injecting. As psychiatrist Dr. Lawrence Hatterer would do the following year, Travel also refused to sample the drug and abruptly hung up. Jacobson later surmised that the real reason for Travel's call was that she realized he now had the president under his control. This control would come into play again at the upcoming Vienna summit, where President Kennedy would soon face off with Premier Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War.
My theory that Josephson, when he was operating in Berlin, was in contact with Dr. Morell, who was Hitler's doctor, quack doctor, who most of Hitler's closest advisors told him to get rid of the guy. In fact, they even thought about bumping him off. However, he could have been, we do know this from some of the history I've read, that the Gestapo went to Josephson and evidently shook him up, and he decided to scram out of Germany. It's my belief that either partially or totally that they convinced him to furnish at least some of his findings, maybe the whole formula, to the Gestapo, which in turn gave it to Dr. Morell. Morell could have received the whole formula or part of the formula, or find out that methamphetamines were the basic, the one that really put you on high and addicted you. And so I say that a Jew poisoned Hitler. Simple as that. It affected the whole war because of this, some of the crazy stuff Hitler did. including the failed invasion of the Soviet Union. He was high on methamphetamines. Now, methamphetamines were developed in Germany, and they were developed ostensibly to keep German Luftwaffe pilots awake so they could fly long hours, especially later on the Eastern Front. So anyhow, that's it for today, and we'll take up this more of this tomorrow. And remember, in reading the book, Hitler, Founder of Israel, remember what we've covered and how Hitler had a lot of contact with Jews in his youth. He had a business for a while, selling his postcards with a Jew. He talked many times about transferring the Jews to Palestine. Charges that a whole bunch of these people that were in Hitler's entourage were partly Jewish, quarter Jews, half Jews, and so forth, which neither side, the West or the Germans, want to have that kind of stuff come out. And so either side, you'll ask them, and they would say, oh, that's ridiculous. That could never be. So it's hard to get the truth. However, they did take a lot of money from Jewish bankers. You know, a lot of guys have written books about how these American corporations loaned Hitler money. But I don't see that they spend very much time exposing the fact that Hitler was borrowing huge sums of money from Jewish bankers. And like Warburg visited Hitler and said what a wonderful guy he was. And of course, that was back there when Churchill was saying what a wonderful guy he was and all that kind of stuff. And if he hadn't screwed the pooch at the Munich conference with Chamberlain, things would have been all right. And all they needed to do was what the National Socialists wanted to do, and that is create a more level playing field in the German culture and society. Of course, remember all the boobs and screw-ups with the Dunkirk situation. I think it was 3 million British troops were allowed to go back to Britain. Well, the problem is Hitler had this strange love affair with England, and I would not disagree with that if it was on racial terms, which I think some of them tried to cover it that way. But he was probably on this meth concoction from Dr. Morell at the time he was making these decisions, these tremendous decisions, because the war would have been over if they'd have captured or whatever those 3 million British soldiers at Dunkirk. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back with another presentation tomorrow. I had to make another file here because I screwed up, but we'll get the webmaster to put them all together and put them up on the website, but I'm sure you can figure this out. And we'll be bringing this. We're going to go along and complete this story about the Feelgood, Dr. Feelgood, first before we go back and complete Adolf Hitler, the founder of Israel, because all this stuff links together. And you start putting it all together and analyzing it, you come up with some very different conclusions than the right wing has come up with over the years, and certainly the major press or anybody else. They don't want to talk about this stuff, and they don't want to admit that there was not nearly the number of Jews died, and most of them died from typhus and so forth and disease in these camps, and that these camps were not to be ongoing forever camps. They were going to be put there and then relocated along towards down towards Romania and so forth, and hopefully get those ships, which thousands of Jews were evacuated before to Palestine. They had A lot of ships went over there, and there was a lot of stuff, and that's what I read to you. But who was stopping it? Who was holding up the deportation? It was the United States and its allies, and, of course, every other country that wouldn't take Jews in. And the Russian submarines were targeting ships in the East Mediterranean there, and they sunk one ship with 700 or 800 Jews on it, killed them all. So the story of World War II and the Jews has not yet been fully exposed. 5.